case for argument this morning is McManus v. Wilson. Ms. Donnelly.
Good morning. I'm Marie Donnelly. May it please the Court. Today I would like to discuss the first and third issues in our brief, that is, whether or not McManus was competent to stand trial and whether or not his execution should be prohibited because he's mentally retarded. In both of these issues, we believe that the state court's analysis ignored a wealth of relevant evidence in resolving the claims and also failed to apply reasonably the correct constitutional standard. Regarding competency, it is not uncommon in a capital case to see mentally ill defendants and not uncommon to see a competency issue. But this competency issue in this case, I think, was very unusual in several respects. Although Mr. McManus has several mental problems, underlying mental problems, he's mentally retarded, for one, and that predisposes him to, he has a higher incidence when you're mentally retarded of a lot of mental issues. He has a mood disorder he has been diagnosed with, and he certainly had a lot of problem with anxiety, especially during this trial, but previously as well. But that condition while that condition was interfering with his competency to stand trial, it was a condition that can be treated. But in this case, it was the treatment, the attempt to treat that condition in the middle of the trial, as much as the anxiety disorder and the panic attacks that he was having themselves, that interfered with his competency. And the judge's refusal to stop the trial to allow it for a proper evaluation so that psychiatrists could see what was going on and decide what drugs were appropriate in what doses and allow him to get used to taking those drugs.
Had there been a competency hearing when the case was first charged?
When the case was first charged? No.
So when he first came into the system, was there ever a question of competency and was there ever a forensic competency evaluation? I know there was not a hearing,
and the trial counsel did not go to the court and ask to have his competency challenged. In fact, trial counsel testified that Mr. McManus was able to cooperate with them prior to the trial. He was able to communicate with them. Although he can't read and had to have things read to him, he was able to assist them, and that he dramatically changed during the course of this trial. So I know there were some early evaluations, and sometimes they automatically render decisions on competency and sanity, but that was not his competency was not questioned until the trial began.
Right. I mean, the reason I ask is because we don't really have a baseline for competency, because there wasn't ever a forensic examination during the pretrial stages of the case.
A baseline for competency?
In other words, there wasn't a ruling that he was competent to stand trial before the trial.
No, there was no ruling before, but counsel never questioned it. They never saw any reason to question that he was competent before.
So what I'd like to explore for a minute is what legal standard you think the state trial judge was using after the panic attack. You know, he goes off, Dr. Mohammadi, you know, makes him, well, I guess the medications get changed before the panic attack, right?
Yes. Well, the medications were changed several times, but yes, once.
Right, but the change that triggers this, as you portray it, descent into a very disturbed phase that never stabilizes, even though perhaps maybe in 4 weeks or so might have. But so the thing that the state trial judge says that concerns me a bit is, well, it's not going to get any better. And so I want to explore what legal standard you think that comment reflects and what you think the legal standard should have been that the trial court should have applied.
The legal standard has been established for several decades. Does he have the capacity to rationally understand the proceedings and rationally consult with his counsel? And that includes the capacity to make rational decisions, as the court said in Godinez. He has to be able to decide, for example, whether or not to testify. And that was something trial counsel was very concerned about in this case. That is the standard under Dusky. It has been repeated in Drope and so many cases I can't think of them. Burt in this court. I mean, that is a very, very well-established standard. And what the trial court said here does not even remotely resemble that.
So even if it was as good as it gets, your argument is that if it's below Drope or the other cases,
right,
that's not good enough. You have to put somebody in institution or whatever until they are restored to the kind of competency you're talking
about. Absolutely. That is our argument. As good as it gets is not a a standard, and that is what the trial court said. It also was not supported by the record factually that it was as good as it gets, because the doctors all seemed to think this could be treated if given a couple weeks to allow him to get used to the medication.
So what do you make, though, of the remarks that a number of the doctors make, Dr. Mohammadi, but he's not the only one, to the effect that he's getting better, you know, he's a little more responsive under the medications than he had been at the time of the first massive panic attack?
Well, when Dr. Mohammadi made that statement, that he, McManus, had in the middle of the trial been put on morphine, given Versed, a drug used for pre-surgery that wipes out your memory, and then given a dose of Xanax, which for the first time. And I think that he said he was comparing this to what he was earlier, where he was completely uncommunicative. He was an emergency room physician, not a psychiatrist, and not appointed to assess his competency, simply to treat him for the anxiety disorder he was having. And he had no experience doing competency evaluations. So he went back at the trial court's request and said, we'll talk to him and see if he can come back in the courtroom. And he came and he said, well, he was much better than he was before. He seems to be able to carry on a conversation. But we also know right after that that the trial counsel said, when McManus did go, because they did, after giving him all these drugs, they did go right back that afternoon into court. And trial counsel wanted to point out for the record that McManus had to be helped into his chair, which, having been given all those medications just prior to that, is not surprising. I think that trial counsel was clear that what the medication may be having an effect, but at this point, the anxiety disorder is better, but it's making him slow his judgment, unable to communicate, and I believe they described him as in a stupor. I think, you know, at this point, it may have seemed better that he wasn't hyperventilating and his heart rate had come down, but that doesn't necessarily mean he was competent. And Dr. Mohammadi also said that he was not competent to assess the effects of the psychotropic drugs that he was giving him, and that McManus needed to see a psychiatrist.
So there's never a point in the state trial proceeding at which the trial court engages in the questions that Drope poses, the ability to assist one's counsel?
I don't think there's any point where the court engages in that at all. During Dr. Whitehead's testimony, at one point, I believe the prosecutor asked whether or not McManus understood who his attorneys were, based on, you know, Dr. Whitehead's had seen him twice during this little break in the trial, and Dr. Whitehead said, yeah, I think he would be able to do that. He also said, I guess we're just going to have to get him in the courtroom to see what really happens, and, you know, that it was difficult to ascertain exactly what was going on because he didn't have the background information. He also was not a forensic psychiatrist, which was obvious when he first came in. He said he was there to treat McManus. He had to ask whether or not there was a confidentiality problem with him testifying. And so, you know, that's as close as they got to ask any competency questions. The trial court's primary concern is, can he sit through this trial?
Well, on that point, does the record reflect why Dr. Whitehead was appointed, for what purpose, what kind of examination? It's my understanding that there's no written order, that this was all done sort of on the fly, and there was a telephone call made to recruit the doctor to come and do an examination, but it's unclear what the purpose of that appointment was.
You're correct. There is no written order. The trial judge did say in chambers that he was going to take care of this himself and call, and if counsel wanted to be present, they could. He described it as, I want him to get fixed up by next Wednesday. And what Dr. Whitehead said in his report is what he told McManus, that he was there to treat him.
I mean, there is a state statutory procedure when there's reason to doubt a defendant's competency, and it requires the appointment of psychiatrists who are qualified to do forensic competency evaluations. It's unclear to me whether that procedure was invoked by virtue of that, both the history during the course of the trial and what was transpiring, but also in that phone call that the judge made.
I don't see how you could interpret this as that. The statute requires the appointment of two, I think it actually says two or three mental health professionals, one of whom at least has to be a psychiatrist, the others can be psychologists, to do an evaluation, to come in, and you would expect them to be educated as to what the standard is and what they were evaluating, to have enough background about the defendant's condition to be able to make a clear determination of what was going on and whether or not it could be treated, whether or not it rendered him incompetent. That wasn't made clear to anyone that was doing an evaluation here. And then if he is found incompetent, you would take steps to restore. This judge was skipping to the chase. I mean, he was just saying, well, if there's any problem, let's fix it right now. And that is, I do not believe that in any way, shape, or form adequately protected Mr. McManus's rights, fundamental rights under the Due Process Clause, to be competent. He was definitely not following the Indiana statute.
Did the judge ever use the word competency during any of the dialogue?
No, he didn't.
Well, I think that after the first panic attack, he did. Say the defendant was competent to assist his counsel, and so he denied them. I mean, it was a summary ruling. He didn't address the standard, but I think he did say he was competent to assist his counsel. The motion's denied.
Okay.
Move on. And that's how I understand the record, that there was at least some awareness of what the issue was.
I don't think he could have been unclear what the issue was, because, or what counsel was certainly trying to make it clear what the issue was, that they could not communicate with their client. They were very clear about that, and they did not think that he was capable of going through the trial. But the trial court never referred to the standard in any meaningful way. But I stand corrected on.
Well, and neither of the medical professionals who were involved during the course of the trial testified to the standard.
No, they did not. In fact, I don't think they had any idea what. Like, one was an emergency room physician. I don't think he'd been involved in criminal cases very much. He sounded as if this was very new to him. And Dr. Whitehead was a local physician that they called in. Again, it sounded from his testimony as if he did not have a great deal of experience.
Well, he was the one who was browsing the internet, right?
Yeah. Yes, he was browsing the internet. He said that several times.
So what about, I have actually two topics I'd like you to say something about. One of them is the question whether the trial court ultimately thinks Mr. McManus was genuinely this disturbed or if he was faking it somehow. And the other question is, what are we to make of the remarks that Mr. McManus later makes at the sentencing stage, which seemed to indicate that he's at least following something. So at one point, this is when the trial court makes the sentence that bothers me about it's not going to get any better, but he says, I'm convinced the condition's either self-induced or, if not self-induced, it's something that's caused by this trial. But as I recall from your brief, you argue that eventually the trial court says it's genuine.
Right. By the end, there was a motion to correct errors hearing afterwards, in which Dr. Michael testified. And at that point, he's ruling again. And he's
the trial judge.
The trial judge, yes. Yes. And so he does say, finally concede that McManus probably was not faking it. I mean, it seemed that the judge began with a hunch. I mean, under the circumstances, he just doesn't want to come to trial. And I have two answers. First, whatever was causing the problem, there were physiological symptoms. The doctors were medicating him, and the medication was affecting him. I mean, he can't be faking the effects of the medication or the fact that they're giving it to him. And so whatever was causing this, whether it was the trial or something else, if he's incompetent, he's incompetent. It doesn't matter. But I also would point out there were ample reason not to believe he was faking it. As I said, he is predisposed to have these kinds of problems based on his intellectual disability. He's had these problems before, even in childhood. One might look at the crime as something showing that he does not have good problem-solving skills, and certainly as someone who has exhibited a great deal of anxiety under stress in the past. But also, he was taken off of one antidepressant and put on another right before the trial. And even if that was medically justified, but it doesn't change the fact that those are two separate drugs. Elavil and Effexor are not, they are both antidepressants, but they are different drugs and they work differently. And Effexor is known, as Dr. Whitehead said, to increase anxiety in some people. He was also taken off a beta blocker right before the trial. And that is something that, I mean, it wasn't given to him to control anxiety. It was for his hypertension, but the side effect of
propanolol, I'm trying to remember, yeah.
And that's one of the things that Dr. Whitehead did, was put him back on that. But so there were ample reason to believe this man was not faking it, and he was certainly exhibiting the physiological symptoms of a panic attack. Mm-hmm. So regarding that issue, and I think the trial judge eventually believed that, and certainly the effects of the medication were what the effects of the medication were. In terms of...
You put information about that into the record, how, through expert testimony at some point?
The effects of the medication, some of it came in the course. I mean, like Dr. Mohammadi said, you know, these are drugs that can affect judgment, but he didn't have a lot of information. Dr. Michael came in the motion correct errors. He was a toxicologist. He described in detail the effects of each medication, the combined effects of the medication, the effect of giving him one after the other without letting one wash out. I believe it was a neuropharmacological soup is what he described his brain as, and said that this would absolutely have affected his judgment. He also said, like the other doctors indicated as well, if given time, he would have adjusted, we could have found the right amount to give him, and he would have been competent if they had just stopped the trial. And you
so
would ask
other
me another question.
Question. The state makes the argument that, I guess, looking at the record as a whole, they can characterize it for themselves, but what I understand them to be saying is looking at the record as a whole, we have, in addition to all of the things that happened at the trial, the statement that Mr. McManus made, or statements, plural, at the sentencing stage, which seemed to indicate that he was aware of at least something that was going on at the trial. He knows who testified. He knows his mother-in-law and his wife's high school friend didn't take the stand. He makes a comment about whether he was faking it and says kind of an odd thing about his heart rate. It looks like a blood pressure reading to me, but anyway, he says his heart rate was 174 over 142. I don't know where he got that number from. But anyway, if you could just comment on his statements at the sentencing and whether they shed any light on whether, in fact, he really was competent to stand trial.
Well, first of all, I would point out that was at sentencing, which was 30 days after the trial, and there were no colloquies.
Maybe he'd stabilized by that time.
Exactly, and there were no colloquies. Astonishingly, there were no colloquies between him and the judge during the trial. But the other thing I would point out is that Mr. McManus, I did read that allocution, I guess, that he was allowed to make, and he does talk on and on about things that he thinks or didn't think happened, but I don't think it's necessarily clear because it wasn't made for the purpose of a competency determination, where he was getting that information, whether it was from his memory, whether he'd been talking with his counsel beforehand about what he was going to say. Or talk about, or what he had heard from other places. I know that, you know, he had been wanting information from news articles and so forth. So I don't know whether or not that necessarily is an accurate reflection of his memory of something or not, but it certainly is not sufficient to dispense with the other evidence regarding his incompetency. I see that my light is on. I did want to talk about mental retardation for a few minutes, or is that okay?
It's all your time, Ms.
Okay.
Donnelly, and if you want to go into your rebuttal, you can, but the 20 minutes is run.
Okay. Just quickly regarding the mental retardation, one thing I definitely wanted to get across about that is that, because I know there will be a dispute about this, is that there's much being said about that Atkins has left it to the states to decide what the appropriate ways to enforce this particular constitutional prohibition. Appropriate ways is a quote. And that somehow that would leave the states free to invent a definition of mental retardation that can say almost anything. I do not believe that Atkins intended that. As far back as Penry, the Supreme Court acknowledged that most of the people who are going to come forward in these cases are mildly mentally retarded. The AAMR defines mental retardation as including mildly mentally retarded. People in the upper echelons of mental retardation, that's with a higher IQ, they constitute 80% of the mentally retarded population and practically 100% of Atkins defendants. If the court is to come up with a definition of mental retardation, directly or by the way they applied it, which is what they did in this case, that excludes that many people, it would render Atkins a nullity. And I believe by applying the stereotypical views that they put forth in their opinion in this case, you know, Mr. McManus can't be retarded because he had three jobs. They were janitor jobs. Mr. McManus can't be retarded because he's graduated from high school in a special education curriculum. Mr. McManus can't be mentally retarded because he was, quote, an excellent father.
That was a little strange. Yeah,
mentally retarded people can certainly love their children.
But here's my question here. I mean, Atkins says what it says, and it sounds to me like you might be asking us to create, say, a boundary that the Supreme Court of the United States itself didn't create, you know, that a full IQ test of 78 is enough, or, you know, we're not allowed to do that, obviously. We have to stick with what the Supreme Court has already done.
That is true, but you have also allowed to determine whether or not their assessment is reasonable. In fact, very recently in a case, Newman versus Harrington out of Wisconsin, that issue was concerned a mentally retarded client, not an Atkins issue, whether or not he was competent. But the court was ignoring the mental retardation. And what this court did was determine that there was an unreasonable determination of the facts because the state court in that instance, their analysis failed to consider the wealth of the evidence. In other words, picking out facts that are inconsistent with mental retardation but ignoring those that are. I also think that relying on stereotypes about mental retardation that are objectively untrue and not in any way supported by the record but in fact rebutted in the record is an unreasonable determination of the facts. So we are asking you to do that kind of analysis. I know that you can't direct them to a particular, you know, they must always do this or they must always do this, but you can certainly look at the whole record and their opinion and determine whether it was reasonable, and especially in a case where they are overturning a trial judge who heard the evidence and found he was mentally retarded and where there were two dissents.
Thank you, Ms. Feldman.
Thank you.
Ms. Miklos?
May it please the court. I would like to start with addressing the competency claim, if I could. The Indiana Supreme Court cited the correct standard. So their opinion applied the facts to the correct standard, and it affirmed the trial court.
But I don't see how it could have if there was no record made in the trial court in which the correct questions were asked. I mean, they can say what they want to. They can say he lived in a different state, for all I know. But if there's nothing in the record to see how he was able to provide the necessary assistance and cooperation with his counsel, where does that come from?
Well, in federal habeas review, we have to look at the last state court that reviewed the merits of the case. And in this case,
it
was the Indiana Supreme Court.
To see if it was an unreasonable, you know, using all of the tests that we look at. But in other words, if the Indiana Supreme Court says something in its opinion, you know, they say the light was green, and you go back and you look at the record and you see that there was never any testimony whatsoever about what color the light was, then isn't that an unreasonable determination of the facts?
In this case, there was
what evidence are you relying on to show that he was competent in the sense of meeting an objective standard, not, well, this is as good as it gets?
Yes, the as good as it gets was not a standard employed by the court.
Well,
it was a phrase that the court made commenting on the evidence and the argument before it, but it wasn't a standard or a legal standard used by the court. And, in fact, we have the trial court's own personal observations of McManus throughout this entire trial is one thing that he bases his decision on.
But we don't
know
what that means.
He described him as lucid and alert. He was cogent. He had a saw colloquy, two colloquies with McManus about his right to testify. And all of those things are reiterated and confirmed by McManus' own statement before the judge in sentencing.
I have big problems with that. But let me go back to the trial. After the experts testify, after Dr. Whitehead testifies in particular, the trial court says, I'm going to deny the motion. I'm convinced it's McManus' condition, either self-induced not, or if not, it's something caused by this trial. These doctors are giving him the optimum treatment he can get. I'm convinced we're not going to face any better situation the next time than what we're facing right now. And I believe we can get through this trial in a proper fashion, and that's what I want to do. So my problem with that is that it just is completely unresponsive to the questions that the trial court is supposed to be asking.
The trial court did not enumerate standards. That is correct. But it wasn't operating under any different idea of rational understanding of the proceedings and the ability to consult with the...
How do you know that? What hooks in the record do you see that link the trial court's observations to Drope against Missouri or Dusky against United States or any of the other Supreme Court?
To address your question, I think it's best to break the trial down into three stages. One is that the evidence shows that through voir dire and through Monday morning, he was competent. There was no indication. His trial counsel did not see any indications that he was not competent. He had a panic attack outside of court, and that's what initiated these concerns. And that was addressed at the time. There was a recess taken. The trial counsel asked for a continuance or a recess. The court granted it. He was treated. And they came back to court on Tuesday morning. And again, he had another panic attack later on in the day. And at each stage, the court was monitoring and was addressing whether the panic attack was needed to be treated by the doctors and was allowing that to be done. So initially, trial counsel was asking for a recess or a continuance because they believed he was ill, because he was experiencing pain from these panic attacks that were occurring once he left the courtroom.
But, you're assuming that to treat a panic attack and to bring that under control equals leaving the person competent to help his lawyers. And it's quite possible to give somebody antipsychotic medications that leave them confused, that impair their memory, that leave them sleepy, that leave them really not in a position to help anybody about anything. And so I'm worried about the equation that you're making between the fact that he's treated, with the Versed and the morphine and the Xanax initially. Then he gets the Xanax and the Lortab. But we don't know how, this sort of lump of a person who comes back into the courtroom is able, during at least some days of the trial, to function with his lawyers.
I would disagree that there is evidence to support that he was a lump of a person in the courtroom. The trial court himself observed McManus and did not believe that he was a lump in the courtroom. And Ms. Donnelly brought up earlier that trial counsel tried to have the judge recognize that McManus had to be helped into the courtroom. And that was a very, I think, critical time in the trial, because that showed the trial court was not willing to acknowledge that he was being helped into the courtroom. What the trial court acknowledged is that the security personnel was taking him by the arm, and that was the extent that he was going to observe what had happened, and it was not as trial counsel had described. And in fact, later, the jail personnel that escorted McManus gave testimony in front of the trial court on that particular issue and was asked, why did you take McManus by the arm? And he said, because I overheard him talking with Dr. Whitehead at the time. It may have been Dr. Mohammadi, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure which doctor it was, but he was I believe it was Dr. Mohammadi, because Dr. Mohammadi had taken a break in his testimony, had gone back to talk with McManus to make sure that the medications were not rendering him intoxicated and that he was rational. So he took a break in his testimony, and the jail personnel overheard that conversation and said it was a normal conversation. After Dr. Whitehead was done testifying, the court made the decision to move forward in the proceedings. And when the security personnel went back to get Mr. McManus, he asked for him to hold his arm because he was lightheaded after getting up from laying down. And that
sure.
was the extent of the
I still feel that there's a gap here. I mean, could you have a normal conversation? You know, are you hot? Are you cold? Are you comfortable? And it seems to me at the same time you might have your memory impaired. You might not be able to recall, particularly under these medications,
and
we don't have a record.
Well, that was a concern of the doctors and the nurse who administered some of the medication, and they talked about those effects. Dr. Whitehead was capable of administering and prescribing those particular drugs.
Even when though he has to cruise the internet to figure out what drugs
he said was, I am not. I should not be prescribing long-term medication. To the extent that his anxiety needs to be handled long-term, he would need to see another doctor for that. So
what
it wasn't
he also
that he
says is, I have never seen a condition like McManus's in his professional experience, but he, quote, got some stuff off the internet on managing it, and one thing the internet source said to use was a benzodiazepine like Xanax. That's what he says.
That is part of his testimony. I think when I was reviewing the record, what stood out to me that I had not included in the brief at the time was from Dr. Gelbort's testimony. That was his own expert that testified that he was insane at the time of the crime and testified during the guilt phase. Dr. Gelbort met with him the night before trial resumed after the week-long continuance to allow McManus to perhaps calm his anxieties, allow the medication to to work with him and allow him to control himself in the courtroom. And Dr. Gelbort discussed a really detailed conversation that he had with McManus. The only adjective that he used to describe his demeanor was that he seemed subdued. And that was the only adjective. To the extent that they had a conversation, it was rational, it was responsive. McManus was talking about things that had happened in the trial and how he felt about particular things about his case. And so, and I apologize for not bringing that clearer to the court's attention when I wrote the brief. But as I was rereading the testimony in preparation for this argument, I really believe that Dr. Gelbort's conversation with him, at the same time that his counsel was saying he was in a stupor, he was slumped, he was unresponsive, we have to delay the trial and in fact have a mistrial. Dr. Gelbort had a very rational conversation with him about his case.
What was the context of that testimony?
Yeah.
He wanted to check on him. He wanted to do another evaluation quickly just to before he testified the following morning to touch base with him, see how he was doing throughout the trial. So it was just, I believe it was, I think it was a 20, maybe 25-minute conversation that Dr. Gelbort had with
McManus. That's what
McManus
he says he had.
In
I can't believe you didn't say anything about this in your brief.
Your Honor, and I overlooked that when I was writing the brief, and it was only when I went back and reread testimony for this.
That may be your only issue. I mean, you know, so, I mean, not that, I mean, we'll obviously try to find it, however, wherever it may be, hiding in this record.
Well, it's in Dr. Gelbort's testimony, and
there's no question that the procedure that was used here was unorthodox when the issue arose. I mean, ordinarily in the Supreme Court, case law requires that when there's reason to doubt the defendant's competency, an evaluation, a professional evaluation for that purpose needs to be undertaken. And it appears as though Dr. Whitehead was appointed to treat the defendant, not to evaluate him for competency and render an opinion to that effect.
I believe Dr. Whitehead was appointed to not only treat him, but make sure that the medications address the onset of anxiety was properly being managed.
Is that the same thing as a competency evaluation, right?
He did not do a formal competency evaluation under our state statute, correct?
Why was that procedure not invoked here?
It wasn't invoked by trial counsel. They did
It doesn't have to be. The judge has a sua sponte obligation under the Constitution.
And because all of the evidence other than trial counsel's arguments was that McManus was capable, he was lucid, he was alert.
The Supreme Court itself said the evidence was equivocal at best.
The Supreme Court identified that some of the witnesses would recognize. I mean, my interpretation of what they said is that they were recognizing that these drugs could have certain effects on an individual. But McManus was being constantly monitored, and at the point that he had the panic attack, I believe, on Wednesday, that was the point where the trial court said, let's take a week recess. Let's have him evaluated.
Right. No, I understand the chronology of what occurred here, but the fact remains that no expert testified to the competency standard, and no finding was made about that.
The trial court did find that he was competent, that he was
lucid.
That
did not happen after Dr. Whitehead's testimony.
And that he was malingering. His intoxications. Dr. Whitehead believed he was malingering.
No, Dr. Whitehead never testified to that.
Yes,
he couldn't make a determination of that.
He never says that.
There was a first examiner that Dr. Whitehead asked to examine McManus for signs of intoxication.
That was a detective.
Correct.
That was not an examiner.
Yes, but then Dr. Whitehead followed up, and he himself believed that McManus was trying
to... He never testified to that. You're exaggerating the record. He was at best equivocal about that. He was hedging. He said, I can't say. I don't know. Maybe. It's a feeling, he said. It wasn't a professional opinion, and it certainly wasn't to a reasonable degree of psychiatric certainty, which is the standard.
I don't believe that I'm exaggerating the record. I believed what Dr. Whitehead was saying is that he could not do an intoxication, complete an intoxication, lead him through whatever series
of... The prosecutor tried to get him to render an opinion on malingering, and he was unwilling to do it. He said, I can't give you that testimony.
I
mean, that was clearly import of what the prosecutor was trying to do in this case.
There, I think if you look at the whole of his testimony, it may have been that he went back and forth, but there were statements that he made that he wasn't able to do an intoxication or complete or get accurate results from an intoxication evaluation. And it may be that he was not labeling McManus as being a malingerer, but he was unable to get the results that he felt that he could if he put forth this intoxication analysis or examination of McManus.
Mr. Close, if I could for a second focus on the Indiana Supreme Court and, of course, the deference that it's due. Accepting, as you said at the outset of your argument, that the standard was laid out correctly by the court on competency.
Yes.
My concern is that the only passage I find, and maybe you can help me, if I've limited myself too much here, with regarding the court's analysis of the trial court's competency finding or implicit finding, the Indiana Supreme Court seemingly explains why the medication was prudent. It says the consensus of witnesses who testified at the trial court's competency hearing, whatever we're to conclude that was that the medications assisted McManus in participating in his trial. And then it goes on to say, that is the Supreme Court, without these medications, McManus proved to be unable to cooperate with the stress of the proceedings. I don't get much in the way of an analysis of the competency finding that you suggest is justified by the trial court in the Supreme Court's analysis. So when we speak to the unreasonableness issue, it's that which gives me some pause, that we don't have much in the way of inquiry into that area.
The Indiana Supreme Court started their analysis. Your Honor, I'm searching for that passage that you just read.
And please clarify whether you're going to refer to their original opinion or their post-conviction.
Right. Sure. I had originally believed you were reading from the post-conviction, but I believe you're reading from the direct appeal, correct?
Yes.
The Indiana Supreme Court began its analysis by identifying the applicable law and standards.
I don't want to question the standard issue. I want to question.
Sure. Then
he shifted the focus to the medication being able to address stress or whatever. But where do we find the focus on competency in the opinion?
They outlined all of the chronology of the facts based on each separate incident where trial counsel asked for a break and there was a break, or there was a panic attack and trial counsel asked for a continuance. So they outlined all the chronology of the facts.
But then if you look at page 43, this the section that Jeff Plum is quoting from, on page 43 of the appendix.
Yes, that last paragraph.
And it's talking about whether it was helping him medically.
Right.
Medications assisted him in participating, but it doesn't tell us. They're in this, like, before or after the trial thing. Before trial, he was competent. Everybody agrees with that. Nobody is in the slightest going against that, but the
yes.
medications change. And then they even have an allusion to competency hearings, but there is no competency hearing.
I would have to disagree. Every step
there
along the way.
There is not a competency hearing, as you've established with Judge Sykes. There is no hearing that focuses on the relevant issues for whether a defendant is competent to stand trial once the problem arises, which is a little bit after the trial starts.
Through the entire trial, his competency was addressed.
There's
it was
no
managed.
Hearing that's
they sought focused. Recesses. They were granted recesses. He was taken to the doctor. The trial court never restarted the trial until he heard from
so the
doctors.
Standard that you think should apply is that there's actually no need for a competency hearing anywhere, despite what the Supreme Court has said, that if the trial court has a gut reaction that the defendant is able, in the face of running back and forth to hospitals and to psychiatrists and so on, I'm not saying just any old person, but you think the trial court's gut reaction without any need for competency hearings that focus on the questions that the Supreme Court has identified is fine. I don't think the Supreme Court has ever said that. But
no, I I'm not advocating
that's
for
what
gut
happened,
reaction.
Though. You're saying that that was
I disagree that that's what happened.
It is what
the
happened.
The motion for mistrial was very specific, filed that we're addressing competency. And before we restart the hearing, because there was a week-long break and they filed a motion for a mistrial, there's no question that competency was always at the forefront of the trial court's mind, of the motives of trial counsel, and that was addressed every step of the way.
But there's a lot of testimony that never comes into this record. If there had been a competency hearing, the lawyers would have testified, probably the jail personnel would have testified. You would have had doctors who were engaged for the purpose of assessing forensically whether he's capable of assisting his defense at the trial, not doctors who were engaged for the purpose of treating his illness. Those are related but not the same inquiries. There's just no there.
Jail person, two individuals from the jail testified.
And the lawyers also testify, and the lawyers say he's all over the block.
And that was at direct odds at of what the trial court himself observed and
but he doesn't
heard
know the
from
sophistication of what's going on. Again, I mean, we've drawn a distinction, I'm thinking of Holmes against Loewenhagen, for example, between the ability to function at a minute-to-minute level, you know, I'd like a ham sandwich for lunch, and the ability to assist one's counsel in one's defense.
There is no evidence that he was not able to assist. Even Dr. Makel's testimony,
evidence, actually, that there is.
There wasn't any direct testimony that he wasn't able to assist his counsel. Even Dr. Makel's testimony, he never examined McManus. He
Has
only
he ever
looked.
Asked that question?
I'm sorry.
Was that inquiry ever asked whether he could assist counsel?
The inquiry with Dr. Mohammadi specifically was, okay, he had a panic attack. You've treated him. Is he rational? Can he conversate? Can he identify who his attorneys are? Can he understand
Mohammadi
the proceedings?
Isn't he also one, the doctor who said that the drugs that have been prescribed might be mind-altering?
Yes, these prescriptions, the medications needed to be administered carefully, and they were walking a line to be sure. Even Dr. Mohammadi, Dr. Mohammadi was careful such that McManus would not be intoxicated by the medications. He said, normally I would prescribe 4 times a day Xanax, and in this case, I'm only going to prescribe 3 times a day or as needed to prevent McManus from being intoxicated by the Xanax.
Is it the state's position that, in effect, a competency hearing was held if you cobbled together all the events? Is that what you were saying when you said to Judge Wood the trial was, in effect, or the proceedings constituted a competency hearing? Is it your view that a competency hearing is in place all the time in every criminal trial because a judge can observe the defendant?
No, I would actually agree with Ms. Donnelly that these were unusual circumstances, and I have yet to find a Supreme Court case clearly establishing what a trial court is to do in this type of situation. McManus was having panic attacks dealing with the anxiety of the trial and in hearing witnesses, seeing photographs of the autopsy. So he was actively having a panic attack in reaction. That was managed every step of the way. The trial court did not restart proceedings until it heard from jail personnel or a nurse or the doctor that
had treated
him. But
we're not dealing with a defendant who has excruciating back pain who's being treated, are we? I mean, you might say, well, that doesn't trigger a competency hearing.
He did have a back injury.
No, I didn't mean to allude to his specific issue.
Yes.
I was just offering up a hypothetical.
Yes.
But here we have a setting where the anxiety attack, the possession error, so to speak, to steal a post basketball term, might seem to point toward issues beyond the stress. I mean, the anxiety may point to something else. It's that which gives me some pause of why we didn't go into a more formal assessment rather than doctors who were, I don't want to say band-aiding, but you know, speaking to the anxiety attack and not to maybe the broader question of competency. I know you want us to read into that, and that's why I started with my inquiry about the Supreme Court, because I think they seem to focus on that aid and assistance for the stress, but don't really give much analysis on the issue of competency other than to defer to, as you suggest, the trial judge's observations.
No, the trial judge's observations are only one piece of the evidence that demonstrates not only that he was capable of understanding the trial and rationally speaking with his...
Well, every trial judge has that obligation every moment of every trial, right? I mean, you're speaking just to the obligation of a judge observing the testimony as it unfolds before his or her courtroom.
Correct. I mean, the trial counsel's own observations are only one piece of the evidence that supports that he was rational, able to comprehend the proceedings and correspond with his attorneys. It also is relying on McManus's own statements regarding what had transpired during the trial. And again, referring you to Dr. Gelbort's interview with him the night before Dr. Gelbort was to testify when the trial recommenced, that McManus was rational. He was able to speak and talk. He wasn't in a stupor. He wasn't observed to be in a stupor by the trial court. And every doctor, Dr. Mohammadi and Dr. Whitehead, all testified that he was conversating. The jail nurse, she could understand him. He could understand her.
So if you can carry on a conversation, your memory is perfect. Is that right?
Well, it depends on the conversation, Your Honor.
Yeah,
if you're
so.
Recalling events from the trial and you're using your memory, then yes,
suppose
it would involve.
Suppose the question is, can you recall the events of the crime?
I'm sorry?
Suppose the question is actually, can you recall the events of the crime, which, after all, is what the lawyers were charged with defending him.
Correct.
About. I'm not sure to say that you can carry on a conversation today without a hearing. I mean, you could have had a hearing. These issues could have been resolved properly, but I don't see the equation.
I
don't see why, because you can carry on a conversation right now. That means you remember perfectly something that happened a year ago.
The challenge by trial counsel initially was that he was dealing with pain from the panic attacks. They wanted him to be medicated, and they wanted it to be addressed.
Have side effects. That's what they're trying to say.
Correct. That came later. That came later in time than initially, and that's why I said I think it's important that we break down the days, Monday, Tuesday, taking a break on Wednesday to the following Wednesday, and then recommencing. So the challenge to the medications did not come until before the trial recommenced the following Wednesday, so after the week-long continuance. And then it also was part of the motion to correct error that was filed later in October of that year. So the panic attacks and being medicated and seen by the doctor, those concerns by trial counsel asking for a recess and asking for a continuance were based on the pain. It was only after that they were concerned about the medication.
Well, there was also a request for a mistrial based on competency concerns. So it wasn't just, I mean, the first impulse, obviously, is to help. And that's what everybody was focused on doing.
Yes.
Because he was in acute distress and he needed to go to the emergency room. But that, in light of the circumstances and what he was experiencing, triggered a reasonable doubt about his competence under the Due Process Clause, and that's a specific inquiry. It's not just a medical inquiry, it's a legal inquiry, and there's a specific protocol that goes along with evaluating that when forensic specialists are appointed, and the question here is whether there's enough in the record to trigger the due process requirement of that specific inquiry, and if so, whether that specific inquiry was made. And the problem here is that the focus was on getting him fixed up. In other words, getting him help to control what he was experiencing, as opposed to what the Due Process Clause requires, which is a specific inquiry into his ability to assist his counsel and rationally and factually understand what was going on. And those questions were never asked.
I disagree. I think that was the only focus of these hearings.
The doctor never testified to that. Neither of the doctors ever testified to the kinds of questions you would ordinarily see in a forensic examiner's report on competency. That there's a specific protocol for that, and that's just nowhere in this record.
But despite not following a specific protocol for this unusual set of circumstances, the trial court managed the onset of these symptoms and balanced the medication that was given to control the symptoms. And he was, by all accounts, by the jail personnel, by the doctors, he was not rendered in a stupor or not being able to respond to them, once he was through the active onset of the panic attack, he was able to correspond rationally with people. So there wasn't the concern, I think, primarily focused on the motion to correct error afterwards. But even looking at Dr. Makel's testimony, he said that all the prescriptions were proper, that the doses were proper. He left open the possibility that McManus could be competent. Looking at that, the change in the medication before trial was done properly. It was weaned before he was put on the new antidepressant. So Dr. Makel's testimony did not change that question that the trial court was dealing with originally. And even based on Dr. Makel's testimony, the trial court was still convinced that at no point was defendant rendered unable to talk, unable to be rational or understand or talk with his attorneys throughout the trial. And in fact, malingering was a large concern during the trial as well. Both Dr. Hilton and Dr. Liffick, who had evaluated McManus for the purpose of his insanity defense, indicated that there were signs of malingering there. And again, so I think there was discernment. I think the trial court was being careful. I think he was trying to get him the help that he needed to manage these active onset of panic attacks, and that at each and every step of the way, his ability to understand the process, to speak with his attorneys, was evaluated by the trial court. And, Your Honor, in my time left, I would just like to make a few comments about the mental retardation. I'm sorry? Oh,
well,
I'm
your
sorry.
Time has expired, but you may have an additional 2 minutes.
Just one, I think, conclusive fact. There is no expert that diagnosed McManus with mental retardation. And on that fact alone, the Indiana Supreme Court's determination that he was not mentally retarded is reasonable in light of the law and in light of the facts. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Nichols.
I wanted to point out, since Ms. Nichols mentioned it, in the record, 1491 is where Dr. Gelbord is questioned about meeting with McManus the night before his testimony. I don't see anything in there that would suggest that McManus was competent. He said McManus was subdued. He was concerned about how he was functioning. He had a conversation for 15 to 20 minutes. He had the only subject he mentions is talking to him about his wife and their relationships prior to murder. And when he's cross-examined, he later says about this, that he specifically didn't talk to him about the murders, and he couldn't remember the exact words that McManus said. So I don't, looking at this, it doesn't seem to me, it's certainly not true that Dr. Gelbort was assessing Mr. McManus for competency or offering any testimony along those lines.
Were any of the physicians in this case aware or does the record reflect whether they were aware of the circumstances of this crime or just that they were called in to address a defendant who was experiencing anxiety attack? I'm trying to see what information base they worked off of.
You mean Dr. Mohammadi and Dr. Whitehead? I'm not sure about Dr. Mohammadi. He seemed to be kind of caught off guard. They were told that he was in a trial at some point and that it was a serious crime, and these were local doctors, and the crime had media attention, so they may very well have known that. I think Dr. Whitehead had enough time to know what the crime was and what the circumstances of it were, and even discussed how it would be a very stressful event to sit through a trial where you're...
Is it true that Dr. Mohammadi said the medicine might restore his competency but never made a definitive finding?
Dr. Mohammadi thought that it was likely, but he also understood that he was being treated. He was treating him with Xanax, and he said, this is not the kind of medication I usually prescribe. You need to have a psychiatrist. So he qualified that. The court has no further questions.
Not. We thank you. Thank all counsel and Ms. Donnelly and Mr. Friedman. You have the extra thanks of the court for accepting this significant appointment.
Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement.